Okay, here we go. You know, Pam and I have come to this church for over 30 years. Actually, it's approaching 35. We just celebrated our 34th wedding anniversary. Who thought she would stay that long? I don't know. But as a consequence, I've taught up here quite a few different times and everything. And, you know, it never gets easier. And it's not easy for me, and I'm sure it's not easy for you to listen to me. So we'll just go on from there. Now, early on in my career of teaching, you know, I did a lot of things to kind of capture people's attention, and you know, I would show pictures of my kids. You know, they were little and cute at one time, and now they've grown older and everything, but I've matured as a teacher. I'm a much more mature man now. I'm better than doing things like that just to grab attention. Okay. I'm not that mature, so let's just leave it right there. I had to include pictures of our grandchildren. On our right is Garnett, and he's almost two. And of course, on the left there is his little sister, Charlotte, just born 9 days ago. Aww. It's amazing what you do for your kids and especially for your grandchildren, isn't it? Because of these two, it's been a busy summer for Pam and I. We've had to help out a lot over there in Las Vegas due to some unusual circumstances. We've been over to Vegas and back again 3 times in the past 8 weeks. In fact, spending almost 5 weeks over there during that time. We've endured 117 degree heat. We've had to sleep on the floor several times. We've even watched Blippi over and over again. Do you know Blippi? Okay, I'm sorry. I think it's the millennials' revenge on us grandparents who made them watch Barney all those years. So, anyways, now many of you have taken the trip over to Vegas. There basically is one main route with a couple variations. You head east on the 91 or maybe the 60 or the 10, and you get over to the I-15, right? And there at the I-15, you have a choice. You can go south to San Diego and cool ocean breezes, or you can turn north and head up to that burning inferno known as Las Vegas. But we make the decision to turn north, and well, in this case, because of grandkids and lots of other family there. And we choose our trip based upon various factors, don't we? And it's not rocket science. In fact, we make some of the same type of decisions every day, don't we? Each week, we make decisions about a trip. Just going to the grocery store, we make the decision. Do we go to Ralph's or do we go to Stater Brothers? Do I go down Broadway or do I go down Orange? Or do I mix things up all together and go over to the neighborhood Walmart over on Beach? Every day we make these types of decisions. We evaluate traffic, we evaluate the prices, the availability of certain items, and we decide where to go buy our Cheerios. Well, with that, we come to Jesus' words for today. As most of you know, what we have been doing here is systematically working our way through the Sermon on the Mount. The Sermon on the Mount is the longest recorded sermon of Jesus, and it's recorded by the eyewitness, Matthew the Apostle. Now, up to this point, Jesus' teaching has been literally mind-blowing to them. As we have noted many times, it was radically different both in content as well as how he delivered it. Rather than musing on what other people said, rather than saying, oh, this rabbi said this and expand upon it, Jesus instead said, I say. He spoke on his own authority, not on anyone else's, and what he went on to say is what they had learned was not enough, literally turning their world upside down. He carefully went through what they had been taught and then taught them his truth, God's truth. They were told, rightly so, not to murder, but then Jesus told them, anger is just as bad. They were taught to give, but Jesus said it wasn't how much you give, but the heart that gives that's important. Now, it's important to note here that what Jesus was not doing was not changing anything that God had delivered to them. He was not changing the teachings of the Old Testament, but rather attacking the additions and the extensions that man had added over the years, how they had tried to reinterpret God's law. So he went on to explain about prayer, about purity, about blessings. emphasizing that what God always intended was not an act, but rather a condition of the heart. And what those people heard that day was both exhilarating, but also disconcerting. You see, up to now, they had been taught a precise way of life. Oh, it was demanding, of course. It was impossible to live, but it was laid out there before them, a set of rules and regulations for them to follow. Do these things, follow this list, and God will like you, so to speak. But what Jesus said was that you could do all those things and still miss the mark. And he summed up everything, rather than expanding on the law of the prophets, rather than giving them a new list of do's and don'ts, he threw away the list and summed up everything in the golden rule we talked about last week. So whatever you wish that others would do to you, do also to them. And so now Jesus starts to close out his sermon. We see he changes his directions now. Rather than talking about specific issues, he takes it up a notch. Not talking about details, but talking about the overall keys to discipleship. Not in terms of a list of things to do, but key characteristics. Because true discipleship is not a list, but a change in heart. And to do that, Jesus does not go into some esoteric teaching. He doesn't go into some grand theology. But rather, he takes us back to the common, the ordinary. Planning a trip. Going out for groceries, so to speak. Jesus uses our everyday life to show us what a life of true living, true discipleship, looks like. In other words, how to plan the trip of your life. And to do that, he not only uses a common example, but he fills the illustration with specific things that have touch points in our everyday life. Gates, paths, destinations, and people. Now, I know these are familiar verses. I'm sure you have heard them taught a number of times. They're ingrained in most of us, so most of us already have pictures of paths and gates in our heads, right? In fact, if I randomly went up to most of you, you could probably speak for 5 or 10 minutes on these just extemporaneously. If we do a couple of those, we'll be done. No. Some of you are too eager to up here to. Anyways, we won't do that. But you know, it's great that it is common. It's great that we remember it. Because Jesus deliberately uses words that not only make his point, but also provides a word picture so that we can remember it. But you see, to these listeners in that day, the illustration is somewhat common to them. The thoughts of two paths was not new to Jewish or even Gentile thought. Time and time again, God reminds them that there are two paths. Even in Jeremiah 21, it says, "Thus says the Lord, behold, I set before you the way of life and the way of death." And the rabbis talked about it over and over again. In fact, the Mishnah records that one rabbi notes, "There are two ways before me, one leading to paradise and the other to Gehenna," or hell. But it's interesting. This was a common example to them. But even when Jesus takes the common teaching, he manages to surprise his listeners. He surprises his listeners with a new thought. You see, while two paths was not new, even before he gets to the paths, he throws them a curveball, the unexpected. Something new, the concept of gates. Two gates, a choice. That was different. Some commentators note that there's no parallels in Jewish literature from that day. What the rabbis taught was different. They concentrated on the paths. But there we are. In the words of Christ, there are two gates. Now, Jesus in that day was talking to primarily a Jewish audience. A group of people that pretty much thought they were saved by virtue of who they were. They were descendants of Abraham, where they lived in Israel, and from following a list of, pretty closely following a list of rules. Sounds kind of familiar, doesn't it? A lot of people think that by virtue of who I am or following a list, I'm good enough. And yet Jesus starts them off not with a path, talking about their heritage or God-given rights, but instead a gate, a choice. In fact, the first word in the Greek text is the same as here in the ESV, enter. Enter a gate is basically the first phrase. Pick a gate, make a choice. So a gate equals a decision point. Now, gates were familiar to them. Obviously, they had them all over the place. And in every walled city, there were gates. And they were used for more than just control points. They were also gathering points. But here in Galilee, there were not a lot of formal Roman walled cities nearby. But there was one very notable one. And it would have filled in the picture for his listeners. As they sat in the hills above the Sea of Galilee, they would have been just a few miles from the city of Tiberias. Here's some pictures. On the right there is what it looks like today, and an artist's rendering of probably what it looked like in Jesus' time. Now, Tiberias was special. It was built by Herod as his capital city in Galilee. It was founded in Jesus' lifetime, maybe just 10 or so years before the sermon was given. And to show his devotion to Rome, Herod named it after the second Roman emperor, Caesar Tiberius. And as you can see, it sits and nestled between the Sea of Galilee coastline on the east and the hills to the west. And it sat on the main Roman road through Galilee. With this layout, there were two main gates, one on the north and one on the south. Now, as Herod's capital, all the government functions were there. So most everyone had been there or knew about it. However, it's interesting that during Herod's time, during the life of Christ, good Jews did not live there for a variety of reasons. First of all, it represented the Romans. It was also the center of the Hellenistic culture, the non-Jewish culture. And it also was considered ceremonially unclean. In fact, Herod had to settle a lot of non-Jews there to help populate it. So, if you were a good Jew in Tiberias, one of the first things you did is you started to think about how to get out. And you really had two main ways to go. Go to the north or go to the south. Go to the north to go to Syria or go to the south to Judea. What a perfect picture of following Jesus. You see, you don't get anywhere on a trip or in your Christian life until you make a decision. Pick a gate. And that is Jesus' first characteristic of the life of discipleship. It is chosen. It is intentional. I think Jesus also uses the common to sometimes kickstart us. It's as if he is saying, here's something you spend effort on, planning a trip, deciding where to buy your Cheerios. But have you spent that much effort in planning your own life? An intentional Christian is one that chooses to walk on the kingdom path. Now, beyond the decision point, there is also a path ahead. And here Jesus uses more descriptive terms for both the gate and also the path beyond. You see, just as there are two gates, there are two paths. It says, enter by the narrow gate, for the gate is wide and the way is easy, and that leads to destruction. And those who enter it are many. For the gate is narrow and the way is hard that leads to life, and those who find it are few. One translation called The Voice starts off the whole thing by saying, there are two paths before you. You may take only one path. Almost yelling it out. Two paths. You see, there is the broad and the wide, and there is the narrow and the hard. First of all, the terms broad and wide are spatial terms. They refer to space, primarily referring to their size and ability to carry a lot of traffic. Now, the interesting thing is that as the people were listening, they probably had a great reference point right there in front of them. As we know, the Roman engineers were great road builders, right? They crisscrossed the empire with a fantastic road system. Now, you probably really can't see that, but this is the picture of the Roman Empire. Those red lines are the main Roman roads, the interstates of their days. But if we zoom in lower on the right-hand corner there, we can see Galilee. Now that yellow line points to a red dot. That's approximately the area that Jesus was giving the sermon. We don't know the exact location, but it was in the hills above the Sea of Galilee. That blue blob in the center there is the Sea of Galilee. However, the blue lines represent the main Roman roads going through that region. There was one along the coast there that was called Via Marius, or the Way of the Sea. On the west side there was the King's Highway, going from Syria to Arabia, east of the River Jordan. However, you see that there was one more crossing the map, crossing Galilee. It not only crossed Galilee, but it went down the west coast of the Sea of Galilee. And it is that main road through the city of Tiberias that we talked about. It's an ancient route that goes from Syria over to the coast and down to Egypt. A route that the Romans used and improved. And as Jesus talked, they were sitting in the hills above it. That very Roman road may have been in view. Some of them may have taken it to get there. Jesus could have gestured to that region and said, the broad way, and then point to the trails in the hills and talked about the narrow way. Whether they could see it or not, they would have gotten the message. You see, the broad gate, that road is inviting, offering plenty of room. It's an easy, well-marked route. Broad and wide are not just spatial terms, but they also evoke a sense of ease and comfort. One can enter and travel comfortably on this roomy road. In contrast, the other way is described as narrow, a term that sounds, well, restrictive, doesn't it? And not very inviting. You see, small and narrow are not just spatial terms, but they balance the illustration by evoking terms in images of difficulty. This is especially true of the latter word, which indicates trouble and affliction. And in the Greek, it is often translated as narrow or to be pressed or closed in on, but also troubled or even persecuted. For example, in 2 Corinthians 4:8, it says, we are afflicted, or the NIV says pressed. We are afflicted in every way, but not crushed, perplexed, but not driven to despair. Afflicted is that same base word. You see, those traveling this narrow road will experience difficulty, especially because the challenge of Jesus' way of discipleship will prompt oppression, even persecution. I don't think I have to say much on that. We know that. We know Scripture teaches that. But to Jesus' listeners, at least at first, they hear the contrast. Wide versus narrow, easy versus hard. The interstate is a safe choice. It gets you somewhere fast. It seems almost a no-brainer. Surely God doesn't want to make our life hard, does he? But Christ warns us, don't make your decision based upon the type of journey it is. If you focus on the path, you will make the wrong choice. When Pam and I drove across the country, we spent a lot of time on the broad road, interstate freeways that crisscross our country. They're great. It would have been easy just to stay on one of those roads and drive to your heart's content. All the time at the speed limit, of course, right? But it is off the interstate that you find Du Bois, Wyoming, or Wetumpka, Alabama, or Shelbyville, Tennessee. So we got on the small roads, because the path was not our focus. You see, the gates, the roads, are not an end to themselves. Rather, the result is. And so that points us to the next point, which you probably guessed from the very beginning. There are two ends. Jesus' example is clear. The choices, the focus, result in different results. Different ends. There are two destinations. The first point here is just that. The possible outcomes is two, not one. All paths do not lead to the same place. This is not about taking Orange or Ball and then still getting to Ralph's. They're not levels of heaven. There's not a good place and a better place. But the world tries to tell us something different. You see, you can get across the country going on I-10 or I-40 or I-80, all different paths, different journeys, but it doesn't matter. You end up at the Atlantic. And that's a common belief today. All good people get there. It doesn't matter what you believe, as long as you are sincere. That's really comforting, isn't it? Unfortunately, it's not true. It's not what Jesus taught. We can go to many places in Scripture, but the one right before us is pretty darn clear. You see, I am ahead. Okay, half it didn't show up there, but you'll get it. The words before us are clear enough, right? First of all, there's the words destruction and the word life, which is the other half that isn't shown on the screen at the moment. One path leads to destruction. This is a common word for eternal punishment. For example, 2 Peter 3:7 says this, "By the same word, the heavens and earth that now exist are stored up for fire, being kept until the day of judgment and the destruction of the ungodly." It's the same word. And this is in contrast to the other destination, life. The Greek word is Zoe. That's not just a great girl's name. It actually means something. It's the common word for life. And that's all that we have here in the text. We interpret it to say eternal life. And many times in scriptures, that word is there. But here, it is just plain life. It is simply the word Zoe for life. Destruction versus life. Christ makes it clear there can be only two possibilities, and they are completely different as life is from death. Christ's teaching to them and to us is quite clear. We're on a journey. We need to make a choice, but we need to do it based on the facts, not just what first looks appealing, but make a choice on what lies ahead. If you do that, if you focus on the destination, the path will not be as important. Enter by the narrow gate, for the gate is wide and the way is easy, and that leads to destruction. And those who enter it are many, for the gate is narrow and the way is hard that leads to life, and those who find it are few. Gates, paths, destination. But there is one more element in the illustration that we haven't covered yet. It's the repeated word in ESV, the word those. In the illustration, we see two sets of people. Two crowds, so to speak. And while there are descriptions of the gates and paths, it talks about broad and narrow, hard versus easy, there's really nothing similar said describing the crowd. There's nothing to say if they are happy or sad, are they partying on their way, or are they drudging along. Only description that's given is their quantity. The broad road has many, while the narrow road has few. Perhaps as they heard these words, they looked down on the Roman road and they saw for themselves the crowds of people on their way, hurrying along the wide road, ignoring or maybe just too busy to notice the group on the hillside. Well, Jesus has a couple things to say about crowds. First of all, these verses make it clear. The majority view is not correct. That is because most people don't think beyond their life here on earth, do they? If the road is broad and the way is clear, they see lots of people on it, that's enough for them. Most people choose a path of least resistance, but true discipleship is a minority position. It's interesting that even nowadays, though, the don't follow the path crowd has actually gotten kind of big. There's lots of people that say, don't follow the crowd, don't follow the path. They're advocating to strike your own path. There's a lot of interesting, people say a lot of different things on that. You can read through some of those. A couple of them are like, only a dead fish goes with the flow. I kind of like that one. That's interesting, huh? But the last couple there, no one achieves great things by following the crowd, have a spine, strike your own path. Or following the crowd is cool if you want to go where the crowd is going. Never fear being the odd one out in order to achieve your own goals. These sound great, don't they? Or do they? You see, while these quotes sound good, and maybe they even have good intentions, they don't encompass all of Christ's teaching. They are missing a part of the illustration. The few. Those who find it are few. You see, Jesus never said, strike a blow for freedom and go your own way. He doesn't say, find your own path. He doesn't say, listen to your personal revelation. He doesn't say, ignore everyone else. And while our path may be difficult and our journey hard, and while most folks may not even notice because they're on some other journey, there still will be people on our path. You see, we walk with a small but unique and distinct crowd. Too often we get half a truth. We see correctly that the majority is not an indicator of the right path. But then we go to the other extreme. We try to go alone. We think that the majority is everyone and that we can't trust anyone else. In many Christian lives, it almost becomes taboo to rely on anyone else. We hear it in many pious ways. I can worship God anywhere. I don't have to go to church. I just need my Bible. I don't need any other books. God revealed it to me. I got my personal revelation, and I don't need help. I just need to get closer to God. While all these statements have sort of a kernel of truth, we abandon God's path for us when we neglect our relationship with other Christ followers. You see, Jesus' teaching is full of contrast and comparisons. And while he doesn't say follow the crowd, he never says to follow a solitary path, to go it alone. He teaches us to stick with our family, and he doesn't leave us alone. He's shown this example over and over in the Bible, and I thought of one time in the Old Testament, the prophet Elijah, a mighty man of God, right? He had just defeated the prophets of Baal, and all of a sudden, the queen was against him. And what did he do? He became afraid and ran away. And why did he run? 1 Kings 19 records these words. He says to God, for the people of Israel, remember, he was an Israelite, so that's everyone else, for the people of Israel have forsaken your covenant, and I only am left. So what does God do after Elijah expounds on that? First of all, he gives him a task. I think it's kind of interesting that no matter what he thinks about the crowds, he says, go anoint a king and a new prophet. You see, no matter what you think about the crowds, the job doesn't change. Keep doing kingdom work. But then secondly, and I think it's interesting that God says it secondly, almost casually, by the way, there's still thousands in Israel that haven't bowed to Baal. You see, God always has his team. God is always working. And even when we think we are alone, there are brothers and sisters, family, all around to help us on our journey. A life of discipleship is one lived in community, a community of believers. Gates, roads, destinations, and people. Jesus captivated his audience with not only mind-blowing information, but also putting it in a ways that they could understand and remember. He takes the common, a road trip, to basically ask them, what road are you on? So let's talk about the next steps. The praise team can start working their way up. It's time to plan a road trip. You want the trip of your life? Here are some principles. We're each on a different step of the road trip, but we each need to take all these steps. First of all, Jesus has taught us, make a choice to go. Some of us have turned to God, but really never taken the next step. Making the choice to be a disciple and follow him daily. Make no mistake, making no choice is a choice. you won't get where you want to go. We must intentionally plan a trip. Pick a gate. And don't plan by the route. Some of us have gone off in the wrong direction, swayed by the condition of the path. And the path can be hard. You see others seemingly having a grand life, but we must not focus on the near-term path, but plan on a destination. We have to look where we want to be, which means we have to look up, check our focus, check our goals, choose a route by the destination. And I think just important, something that we often forget, is that we must walk the path with others, with our family. Many have gone before us. We should know and study them, understand the path that they have already marked out for us. And we should leave our own trail markers for those who follow, markers of a life well lived, a life of faith. And family, of course, we need to find and walk with those that are on the trail with us now, helping, encouraging as we pick our way through this trail of life.